Robert Martin from Philadelphia, Curtis Institute graduate 1971. Let's hear it for him.
Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to episode 49 of the ZappaCast. I can't believe our luck. By our, I mean myself and, of course, our producer, Phil Circus. Say hi, Phil.
Hey.
I can't believe our luck today, because this is our guest today is a gentleman that I've been looking forward to talking to since I asked you last year when you guys were on the Hologram Tour. Keyboardist, sax virtuoso, one of the great voices that I've ever heard, certainly working with Frank or anybody else. Robert Martin is on the show today. So hi, Robert.
Hello, hello. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, delighted to have you here. So how are you faring with everything that's going on? I know obviously the tour earlier this year got postponed, as did everything else in this.
Yes,
world.
from what I understand, they are scheduling it for exactly the same time frame, summer of 2021. So it's a double bill with King Crimson and the Zappa Band, which should be huge fun.
Yeah,
and it's going to be East Coast, starting in Florida and working our way all the way up into Canada through June and early July. And then there are rumors, mind you, not dead set at this point, that we might also pick up a short leg on the West Coast when that East Coast leg is done.
That will be definitely good news for Phil, Phil saw you, I think he probably already told you, but you saw him at the Baked Potato.
No, actually at the Whiskey. I saw the show at the Whiskey.
Oh, at the Whiskey, the Whiskey.
That was mind blowing. After seeing you in 81 and 84 and 88, and then to see you up there with Ray and Scott and Mike Keneally, it was a fantasy come true. It was so great, so musical.
What a band that was. I mean, it's.
Well, that was a fun night. I remember. I mean, anytime we get to play in LA, whether it's the Potato or the Whiskey or whatever it might be, it's always some kind of magic. I mean, usually people, I believe, as I recall, Ian was there at the Whiskey too.
Yes. Yeah.
He comes to the Potato when we're there and various people show up. So, you know, it's kind of like what Zappa used to be. Spontaneous, wonderful magic happens and you never know when or exactly how that's going to be, but you know that it will.
We were talking about, I think with Joe Travers,
right.
We were talking about the way that the harmonies are stacked, and where, you know, to hear you and Ray White sing together is one of life's great joys, you know, like it was joyful. I saw several shows on the tour and it was just, you know, it was a joyful experience for me as a longtime fan. Your voice hasn't aged.
No, that joyful aspect began from the very first minute that we opened our mouths together on my audition in 81. I'll tell you about something that happened during the audition as well. When I, after I did a bunch of playing and sight reading and various instruments and all that, Frank said, well, I understand you sing high and strong and all that. Let me hear you sing. What do you know? And I said, I don't know. I didn't, because I hadn't prepared anything. I just got word of this the night before the audition. So I figured the way to handle this is, I mean, I could stay up all night, try and shed a bunch of things and learn a bunch of things, or I could just go to sleep, show up rested, do what I do and be who I am. And that seemed to be the better way to go. And that's what I did. But anyway, after a bunch of playing and, you know, going through various instruments and transposing this and that and sight reading and all, Frank wanted to hear me sing. So he asked me first, and I said, yeah, I sing a little bit. And right then I saw Ray kind of throw his head back and chuckle. And I found out why afterwards, because when he auditioned, you know, a few years before, same thing happened. He played some things and then Frank said, well, do you sing? And Ray said, you know, in his humble way, yeah, I sing a little bit. And then he opened his mouth and blew everybody away. And it was basically the same thing when I did it too, because I sang, you know, I just said, I don't know, Auld Lang Syne. So he said, okay. And I sang it in natural voice, an octave higher than you would imagine an uncastrated human male could come up with. And everybody just kind of dropped their mouths open, and that was it. Auld Lang Syne was the thing that locked it in. But it was kind of funny before that happened to see Ray chuckling about what I had said. And I asked him afterwards, and we had a laugh about it. First thing he said to me was, after we took a break, after the audition and hung out for a bit, he came up to me and said, all right, man, what church you been hanging out at? And I said, Church of Etta James, because at that point, let's see, this was 81. I had started working with her when I first came out to LA I moved out to California in fall 75 and up to Hollywood in 76. And one of the first connections I made was Etta James. And I started a gig with her and ended up doing like the Rolling Stones tour with her and all kinds of things like that. In 78, we opened for the Stones in 78. To me, that has been my ongoing education. I think of it as spending 15 years at the Church of Etta James and quite a few years at the University of Frank Zappa as well. And that was my master's and my doctorate.
I'm glad you brought up Etta James, because I hope Zapcast listeners know how utterly mind-blowing your career is. Mm-hmm. Like even before Frank Zappa, and like you played French horn on all these like Philly soul classics.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like Backstabbers and I'll Be Around. And yeah. Which is,
Me and Mrs. Jones,
Jones.
By Now, all those classic things that we did there, Money, Money, Money. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I was 20 years old. Wow. I was studying at Curtis and, you know, I was a hot new young guy and was like top call player on all those sessions. And, well, I had already gotten two very, very valuable concepts drilled into me, especially while I was at Curtis. Number one, show up early. Number two, play it right the first time. All you have to do is those two things and you will be the top gun and they will keep calling you. So that worked out real well. And up until the time I left Philly, in fall 75, I played on just about everything that came out of Sigma, and it was a wonderful experience. And I still look back on those days and those experiences. And I mean, that was very much in the early days. The Sigma Studios had just recently opened, and they had just gotten their 2-inch 16-track analog tape machine, which was still, to me, the coolest, the best analog format ever. So I first started working there in 68, which is 1 year after the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper on 3 tracks. So I have grown through the metamorphosis of the of all this technological change.
So you are obviously from Philadelphia, but how do you get involved in music? Because I know you started with the French horn, but how do you get involved? Or was that a school thing, or how did that work?
Well, you really got to go back all the way to the beginning. My parents were opera singers. They the way they met was they had the opposite lead roles in the 1939 Philadelphia Cosmopolitan Opera Company production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado.
Wow.
She was Yum Yum and he was Nanky Poo, and their characters in that show married, and they got married in real life. And so I was exposed to music right from before popping out of the womb, even. And Philadelphia in the 50s, I was born in 48, but as a young boy in the 50s growing up, I could not have asked for a better time and place to have grown up to become a musician. Philadelphia in those days, well, first of all, in terms of rock and roll, American Bandstand began in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Long before it moved to California. And in fact, I was watching it before Dick Clark was on. There are not many people know there was somebody before Dick Clark. And because I was the youngest of three kids and my parents were musical, I was exposed to all kinds of music very early on and never discouraged from it. They never pushed me into it. They never held me back from it. They just kind of let me do what was natural. And what was natural was to soak all of this stuff up like a sponge. The Philadelphia Orchestra has always been one of the greatest in the world. And from the time I was a tiny tot, we used to go to Philadelphia Orchestra concerts, especially in the summertime at this venue called the Robin Hood Dell, which was an outdoor kind of amphitheater in Philadelphia. And the jazz scene was always very strong in Philadelphia. Coltrane lived in Philadelphia for a while.
Yes.
So everything was there, and there in spades. I mean, it was like a smorgasbord of the best you could get, and everything available all the time. So I was just soaking it all up, and I became a Ray Charles freak when I was like 9 years old, and first heard him on the radio in 1957, and then in 1959 he put out a record, and his saxophone player at the time was a guy named David Fathead Newman, who just had this sound on tenor that was the coolest thing I had ever heard in my 11 years of life at that point. And I said, whoa, I got to make that sound. I got to learn to do that. So, you know, that kind of thing was happening constantly. And Etta James, let's go back to Etta for a minute. I first saw Etta James on Bandstand when I was 8, 1956, she was 18 and had her first hit record. And I was 8 years old and watching her on Bandstand. And, you know, years later, I was working with her. And that happened a lot of times. I experienced the kind of situation where someone who was an unknowing mentor to me, because I was studying them from afar, I would end up working with them. Mm-hmm. In 1987, I ended up co-producing Wilson Pickett's comeback album on Motown Records. And he was a big influence on me in the 60s when he was like one of the top soul singer guys. So those kind of things happened a lot. And the first time I saw, I was very much aware of Zappa from the beginning. Freak Out came out in 66, which is the year I graduated high school. The following year, 67, he came to Philadelphia and played at a venue called the Spectrum, where the 76ers used to play and the Flyers used to play, and they used to have concerts. I saw Hendrix there. I saw an amazing concert in the 60s. I saw the Beatles live.
Wow, really?
I'm one of the few humans that's actually saw the Beatles live. But all kinds of concerts were going on there, and I was just jumping into all of it. So I saw Frank in 67 at the Spectrum. 7 years later, in 74, I saw him again at the Spectrum. That was that great band with George Duke and Nappy and Tom Fowler and Chester and Ruth. And so, you know, and then 7 years after that, in 81, I was in the band.
So it sounds like you were a fan way back.
Yeah.
Way back. But when did you first get a notion like, I'd like to be in his band?
I didn't. I never did. It just happened that way. And the way that I can tell you about that one, too. In 77, I joined the group Orleans, which was a sort of a almost yes. like a country rock pop band based out of Woodstock. And we got a record contract, and there was a lot of, it took a long time to actually get out, for them to get out of their old contract and into the new one. So in the interim, that was like 78 and 79 before I got to you know, the whole Zappa thing didn't come up until 81. But in 77, I joined Orleans, and we actually recorded that album in 79. And in 79 and 80, we did some college tours with them. We recorded the album and had a hit record from it. And the guy that was the head of the tech crew for Orleans was a guy named Dave Robb. And then after Orleans split up in 80, somehow or other, he made his way to L.A. and got on Frank's crew and became Frank's guitar tech. And so in 81, when Frank was putting the band together for that year's tour, Dave was basically, you know, watching the whole audition process go on and watching one person after another get the axe and get the hook like Gong Show, and you know, watching Frank just get frustrated and just not being able to find the right person. So finally, Dave said, "Hey, man, I think I got the right guy. I know a guy that I think could be the one." And so Dave told Frank about me, and Frank said, "Great, get him down here tomorrow." And that was, you know, that was the pre-audition setup to that the day before.
Wow. So
that was basically just knowing people in the industry, doing what you do well, and treating people well, and your reputation will precede you and follow you. And call it what you want, karma or whatever. You do good things like that. You do good work, and you put yourself into it with everything you've got, and you'll succeed. So that was basically a good example of that kind of thing going on, and knowing people and having them remember you. I'll say, "Oh yeah, man, that's a guy that would be great for this spot." And they make it happen.
See, you and Scott and Chad, I think, were the three constants throughout basically the last three tours.
We all came in together in 81, the three of us, and we're also the only three humans on Earth that did every Zappa tour from that point on.
That's right. See, one of the interesting things is that by the time you get to 81, Frank is looking to do more advanced stuff on stage. So were you particularly good sight reading material? I mean, I already know the answer to this, but how did your sight reading work with what Frank wanted to do?
Well, that was fine. I mean, my main instrument for many years was the French horn. I mean, that was what I was studying. That was my focus at Curtis Institute, which is harder to get into than Yale and Harvard. So that prepared me well. And being a French horn player also prepared me well, because transposition, in other words, looking at a piece of music in one key and playing it, playing different notes than what you're reading,
yep,
while you're looking at those notes and playing different ones, is rather confusing and difficult. But you must learn to do that and do it fluently as a French horn player, because the nature of the French horn, when it was first adapted into the orchestra back in the days of Bach and Mozart, valves had not yet been invented. So it was a different instrument. It was a valveless instrument, which limited the number of notes you could get out of it. Because of that restriction, transposition became a way of life in French horn. A modern French horn player in a symphony orchestra today has to read music that was written a couple hundred years ago, before valves were invented, and they were constantly using horns with different length tubes in them, three or four different guys, one playing each length of horn. And okay, you play this, and then if they go to a different key, you can't play that anymore. The next guy's got to play it because he's got a horn in that key.
Yep.
And we have to now read all of those parts that are combined together on one instrument and constantly, sometimes bar to bar, change transpositions. Okay, I got to read this bar third down from what I'm actually looking at. And this next bar, I got to play a second up from what I'm actually looking at. So you have to do that. So again, that kind of mental gymnastics, as well as the mastering things physically, prepared me really well. I'm very thankful for that training. I mean, it fit really well. It just just interlocked perfectly with so many things that Frank was about, in that he would demand that his players play authentic heavy metal, and then authentic 18th century classical, and then authentic free jazz, and one bar into the next, and then play authentic Mr. Rogers style or Holiday Inn style or reggae, and do it at the drop of a hat from one to the next. So you had to be not just technically ridiculously proficient in order to manage the difficulty of the things he would write, but you also had to be versatile and authentically so in all of these different styles and genres.
Did you get vocal training as well, or did that come to you through?
No, that was just
no vocal training.
No vocal training.
Wow.
And here's the really bizarre thing. When I was younger, when I was 18, my final year of high school, I was 17, actually, I was a bass. I could not sing high to save my life.
Wow, really?
If you know anything about musical range, my highest note was like an E or an F above middle C. So I was bass baritone. Then in my late teens and early 20s, this range just started to stretch and stretch and stretch and appear. I think it may have been because a lot of the situations I was in then, in terms of rock bands and things, I wasn't singing a lot of lead. I was singing a lot of backgrounds, and I wasn't trying to make myself sound like James Brown or Wilson Pickett or doing all this crazy screaming stuff and all. So my voice grew in strength and range without abusing it. And this insane high register began to appear. I guess you would say vocally, I was a late bloomer. It didn't really cement and finish growing until I was in my late 20s. And by that time, I could sing so high in natural voice, not falsetto. I didn't need falsetto. I could sing as high in natural voice as I could in falsetto. So it was just crazy, and I never lost the bottom. I still had the bass range that I had had before that. So Frank was just over the moon with that available for his sonic palate to play with, you know. He had me spoof operatic cadenzas, I'm sure you know, like, you know, baritone yep. women and stuff like that. And I was kind of like the stunt vocalist. That was a lot of fun. Again, that didn't show up until, you know, my late 20s, really. But they say, you know, like an opera singer really doesn't hit their stride until 30 at the earliest. Mid-30s is more like it, when they really get mature and really powerful and really in command of what they have going on in their larynx.
I'm used to these sort of, you know, your stereotypical rock vocalist screaming guy who will burn his voice out, or largely burn it out, certainly by the time he's 40, if not 30. So right. Improper technique.
Yeah, mine didn't even develop. No. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Frank used it.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. He used it right away, right on that first tour. I mean, you know, you guys were doing Whipping Post on that first tour.
I've been run down, Lord, and I've been lied to. And I don't know why I let that mean woman make me out of fool. Took all my money, wrecked my new car.
Well, that was an interesting story too. That song came out in, what was it, 70, 71. And that was when I left Curtis and started playing in a local band around the Philly, South Jersey area. And we had a lead singer, because again, I was like 22 at the time, and I had not yet developed. I had a strong voice, but I didn't have anything like the range I would eventually develop. Mm-hmm. And we had a lead singer. My function in the band was primarily keyboards, primarily B3 and saxophone, and background vocals. And so I knew that I was a good singer and a strong singer and a soulful singer, but I didn't have the range to pull things off that I was hearing in my head and wished that I could do yet. So when we were, you know, when we started doing things like that, the lead singer would sing the song, and it always frustrated me because I thought, damn, I want to sing that song. It's so cool. So a couple of years later, I was in a different band, and I, my voice had strengthened, and it was not with that lead singer anymore. So it came to me, and I started singing Whipping Post in the early 70s. So one day, out of the blue, in a rehearsal for the 81 tour, before we went out, Frank just said, you know, I didn't see it coming, and I didn't know where it was coming from or why. He said, hey, do you know Whipping Post? And I said, do I know Whipping Post? Yeah. And he said, great. Teach it to the band, have it ready tomorrow. I want to hear it. So I did, and we worked it up, and that became the most programmed final encore from that point on.
I mean, it's one of those things I never get tired of hearing on, you know, on the many, 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 many bootleg tapes I have of you guys.
Again, speaking of, I guess it goes in line with the idea of early bloomer vocally. I also hear, when I listen to those different performances from the different years, I hear a very distinct development in my grasp and understanding of the song and ability to do things with it that I didn't really dig into in earlier versions. My favorite one is the Barcelona concert. Yep. From the 88 tour.
Mine too.
Also, one of the interesting things about that is that I changed the lyrics, as I'm sure you know. And the reason happened was because of a funny thing that had happened the night before with one of the guys in the crew, which I won't bother to go into and all, because it's not exactly a family friendly story. But that was the kind of thing that happened often. And Frank would change lyrics a lot, too. And we'd all be laughing and looking at each other like, OK, where's this going to go tonight? Because, you know, we often didn't know. But then, you know, Frank would start like, you know, the word, the magic word would appear somehow or other. And that would become thematic throughout the rest of the concert. And we would, on the fly, be changing lyrics and guess what Frank was going to do. And a lot of times we guessed exactly right at the right time. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't, it was just a funny thing. And we nailed it the second time it came around. So things like that, while there was very, very strict discipline in terms of playing things, especially the more complex written things, playing them accurately, and I mean accurately. We would, for instance, we would drill the 11 tuplet at the end of Black Page, just cycle it and cycle it and cycle it and play it again and again, so that those 11s over the 4-4 bar would be equal. Wow. And it wasn't like 5 and then 6. Mm-hmm. It was every note was 1/11th of that time. Yep. That the time from the beginning of that bar to the end of the bar was exactly divided up into 11 segments, and we played an accurate 11 over top of the 4. And in order to get things like that, you had to work, you had to think, you had to focus.
Yeah, you can hear it because there are rehearsal tapes, as I'm sure you know, that are out there that fans can they pass around and all that stuff, you know, bootleg stuff. And the amount of preparation that goes into something like, well, really, like any of the material that you did is just, it's astonishing, you know? I mean, I don't think any band ever worked so hard to put something out there on the stage for people.
You know, what's really amazing is that sometimes when I play some of these old videos for people, they don't notice it at first. Mm-hmm. But then when I point it out, they'll just be floored and they'll think, whoa, look, nobody is reading music. They're playing this insanely complex stuff for 2 hours, yes. All from memory.
No breaks.
No breaks.
Yeah, no breaks. All from. And what I discovered, I would not have believed that the human mind could store, let alone with fluidity, retrieve that mountain of data and do it instantly after not accessing it for a month.
Yeah.
You know?
That's such a staggering thing, especially about the 88 tour where how many songs were memorized for that? Like three separate shows, maybe more than that?
Yeah, we had over 5 2-hour shows memorized by the end of that tour. And we're talking Zappa music, not 1-4-5 blues changes.
Right.
And no idea at the beginning of the night necessarily. I mean, you know, you were given the set list before you went on and that's what you played.
We always had the set list.
Yeah. Frank would write out the set.
But and the set would pretty much be, you know, the roadmap. But within that roadmap, there would be detours.
Yes.
And you know, changes on the spur of the moment. And you never knew what they might be, but you had to be ready for it. But what I discovered in terms of the sheer bulk of material was by the time you practiced something like Black Page enough to have it under your fingers, it was in your brain. Mm-hmm. It was memorized. So it wasn't like the memorization had to be a whole separate operation. That would just went along with practicing to physically get it under your fingers.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Phil, you brought up how big the repertoire in 88 was. The 84 band actually had a huge repertoire as well. They don't get as much credit for it, because they don't have the five-piece horn section, but they had a pretty amazing repertoire, as did the 81 and 82 band. So you were always working with a huge,
they all did,
you know, catalog.
You mentioned those rehearsal tapes, and if you've heard some of those, another thing that's remarkable that will be revealed there is that Frank would constantly change things throughout the rehearsal process. And the next day when we went to do that song that we had rehearsed and gone through 5 or 6 variations of before we got to the one he wanted, the next day we would come back and he'd say, I don't like the one we ended up with. Yeah. Let's go back to number 3. And we're like, what? What was number 3? So, yeah, it was just crazy.
We were recently gifted the 6 CDs of the 1981 Halloween shows.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I thought I was familiar with a lot of that material, but going back and hearing so much of it, there were arrangements that just were brand new to me. Right. I was wondering if you've had a chance to sit down with that set and listen to it and if it brought up any thoughts of those shows.
Broken hearts are for assholes. Broken hearts are for assholes.
You're an asshole.
Broken hearts are for assholes. And you're an asshole too. What you gonna do? Cause you're an asshole.
I haven't really delved deeply into it. I mean, I've heard some of it and compared some of the duplicates from different nights. And again, you can hear that there's a foundation there, but you can also hear that a major aspect of Frank's approach and therefore the approach of the band and all of us was that it was like, I don't know, I go back to my days as a boy with Walt Disney and the Mickey Mouse Club. Anything can happen day. Thursday was anything can happen day. Well, anything can happen day was every minute working.
That was one of the things I was going to say when we were talking about the secret word before. You have to have an amazing amount of technical ability to handle what you're supposed to handle and then have the secret word thrown in on top of it, because there's a great moment from one of the 88 shows. I'm trying to remember which one, but it was Jazz Night. And you guys were just kind of making all these kind of, you know, stereotypical jazz references, and you're playing a keyboard solo.
Right.
And you stop and you go, are we in A or A flat? And the band just dies. It's great. It's one of my favorite moments at a Zappa show ever. And you all shared that humor, you know?
Yeah. there was a lot more jazz going on in that band on that tour because we had those five amazing horn players. That was another really cool thing about Frank. There are a couple of things that I'd like to touch on. One of the things that made it very different was, unlike most touring situations, a lot of which, in fact, quite a few, if not the majority, I would say, of the tours that I did, you played the same set every night. And it had to be that way because of the production that went into it. There was lighting cues, there were set cues, there was all kinds of things going on that had to be the same way every night or it would be insane. But, you know, Frank's whole thing was not about that. It wasn't about production. It was about the music. So, you know, there was a, like I said, with the set list and all, there was a foundational aspect along with the spontaneity of it. And Frank would tailor both the material that we played and the arrangements of that material, which, as you know, were constantly changing from tour to tour. You'd hear City of Tiny Lights on one year and the next year it would be entirely different. And Frank, unlike a lot of other situations where you are expected to fit yourself into the mold of what the show is about, Frank would work it the other way around and look at the potential of all the individual players he had gathered for that particular ensemble, for that tour, and he would tailor the set list and the arrangements for that. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you look at the, especially the 88 tour, the arrangements of the songs that were now very, very much horn oriented that never were before when he didn't, when he had only one or maybe no horns. So he would do it. That was one of the aspects. And the other was that, unlike a lot of situations where a star, quote unquote star, will hire the best people she can get or he can get for their band for that tour. And again, you had to fit into a specific mold and do it this way, the way that great musician XYZ did on the tour before you, and they got used to that. So you got to do it that way. Mm-hmm. Frank would do it exactly the opposite way. And again, rather than put you under the thumb and squelch your capabilities and limit you to what they needed and wanted and do it in such a way that you did not outshine the star, Frank would put everybody under the microscope and find every possible sound you could make and figure out a way to use that sound, even if it was like a body noise or whatever, to figure out a way to use that musically to his advantage. So there were so many things that were different about it, but those two aspects in particular, I enjoyed very much.
You actually were not necessarily replacing anybody that came in from the last band, like in terms of your position. Frank kind of created work for you to do. So you kind of not only pioneered that position, but you actually, that was your position for the, you know, as long as Frank continued to play music.
Yeah, in a way, again, that's an interesting observation, and it holds true in a lot of ways. And like everything else with Frank, there's always exceptions as well. For instance, when the first two tours I did, 81 and 82, Ray was there, but Ike wasn't.
That's right.
Then in 88, Ike was there, but Ray wasn't. Mm-hmm. So 81 and 82, I did stuff that Ike would have done before, like Bamboozled by Love, things like that. And then in 88, I did Illinois Anima Bandit and City of Tiny Lights because Ray wasn't
there. That's right.
Which was great fun for me because I got to sing the things that these other great singers had done and steal their good stuff and add some of my own. And 84 was the only time when all three of us were together. And that was quite the vocal powerhouse, that 84 tour.
Yeah, that was very much a vocal band. I love that band. And you actually had Napoleon Murphy Brock at the very beginning of it.
Right.
So there was another voice to add to it.
Yeah, it was overkill, actually, when it started out. I mean, when I came in 81, the vocal stack was Frank on the bottom and then Ray and then me on top. And that had a great sound. I love the sound of that.
Hobnobbing with the goblin, the goblin girl from the mystery world.
And then in 84, we flipped me up so that I was an octave above Frank. And Ray was then under that, and Ike was under Ray, and Frank was on the bottom. So that was pretty crazy. And then, you know, for the short period of time that Nappy was there, we adjusted things around that as well.
Now are you fool? Don't you know you're crazy? He won't be true, but your mind's a little hazy. He'll break your heart.
That was even more challenging for me because I was now singing higher than ever because I had to be up an octave from Frank much of the time. So, but that was okay. That was in my wheelhouse and it wasn't hard. And you know, again, by the time we got to the tour after all the rehearsal we did in to be prepared, my pipes were strong. And by the end of the tour, again, because I wasn't thrashing my voice and abusing it, I was insanely strong. And I could have, when I go back and listen to those things, I hear myself singing at the end of the night and doing like whipping post and just roaring with it and thinking, yeah.
The classic example is the Does Humor Belong in Music video, and you take it out with whipping post. And that,
right.
I used to be, when I was a kid, I used to be able to imitate your vocal on that. I can't do it anymore because I sang rock and roll and destroyed my voice. So that was, but that is just an inhuman vocal on that. It's so great that even that, you know, I mean, every time you did it was great, but what a way to end that video, boy.
Yeah, well, it was always fun for me. That's for darn sure. I always look forward to it.
I'm going to say it again. I believe there just ain't no such thing as dying.
I mean, you must have had some kind of a personal relationship with Frank on the road, and did the bands always got along, and it was kind of like a family. That's the feeling that I get.
Pretty much. I mean, I'm sure you've heard some of the stories about the early demise of the 88 band and all that. And,
yep.
And there was some friction there for sure. But there was also an awful lot of camaraderie, even in the midst of that. And on all the other tours, there was never any significant kind of friction, really. In fact, I would describe it as pretty much, in my experience anyway, the opposite. It was, and I think it was largely because when you reach the level of individual that can accomplish what you have to become to perform one of those tours, let alone, you know, a single concert, let alone a whole damn tour of that stuff. It also, I think, develops your intellect and your psychological development to a point where, again, this is my experience and my assessment. It may differ from others drastically that you might talk to somewhere along the line. But my view of the people that I interacted with and worked with in those bands were that they were very high functioning individuals on many levels.
Yeah, it is interesting because the way that the shows always come across to me is that you guys are really just, you know, and as an amateur musician myself, just in little bands around here in Connecticut, I can't imagine the kind of pressure to perform accurately every night that you must have been under. However, you just always look like you're having fun. So, and fun can break right out at any time.
Yeah. Again, the amount of preparation that went into that, well, the amount of preparation that went into each one of us as individuals before we even got in the band. And then the preparation as a unit before going out gives you a level of confidence that is natural and easy. and makes it so that you can be relaxed and have fun under what might be considered an extremely high stress situation. But because you know you can handle it and you're prepared and you've been getting prepared your whole life for this, and that's where you belong, with that state of mind, it does make it a very enjoyable experience.
So the first couple of shows of the 88 tour, you're still Bobby Martin, and then you become Robert Martin. Was there any particular reason for that, or was it just like Frank?
Well, you know, Frank? I had been trying to get him to introduce me as Robert, I think maybe even going back to 84.
Really?
And I just felt like, you know, Bobby Martin sounds like a baseball player or something, you know, and I am a baseball player.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, we got Robert Palmer. We got Robert Plant. Come on. You know, that's the name my parents gave me and I want to use it. So I finally convinced him to introduce me as Robert.
Oh, that's great.
And I went for it, and, you know, he didn't give me any shit about it.
That's great. Sorry, Phil. I've been taking up all the oxygen here.
No, this is great. This is great. And you're great. Actually, I'm just formulating kind of a question in my head now, because you brought up 88. And yeah, a lot has been kind of written and said about it. And but then, you know, I saw you at the Whiskey about a year ago. I'm just wondering, despite all that has been written, does it sit better in your memory now? Now that like so much time has passed?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for the question, because it does open up a lot of interesting aspects. One of which that I heard recently is that we as humans, as we get older, tend to look back on memories with a more positive viewpoint than we may have had in the moment back then, which is a good thing, because otherwise life for old people would be hell. So there's that. And then there's also the fact that you, hopefully anyway, and for the most part, I think we largely do, all of us succeed in growing up as we grow older and developing an ability to look at things in a more open way than we could before, and understand things more deeply than we could before, understand people's motivations, understand their actions, be empathic and considerate of their actions and what they may have been dealing with when they did something that displeased you. And, you know, you can look back at it and, you know, kind of restrain yourself and say, well, wait a minute, you know, let me walk a mile in their shoes, see what's up. So we have those of us that still do this music together in various different formations over the years have all learned to, it's almost like we don't even think about it. It doesn't matter. It's not important.
That's, I think it was very important to me, that just as a fan and knowing what he brings, that Scott Tunis be part of the Hologram Band.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love Scott. And I would say that, thinking back to things that went on in the 88 tour, I like to think that I had a better relationship with Scott than pretty much anybody else in the band. And I have to say also that was from day one back in 81. You know, I picked up right away that Scott could be what some might feel was abrasive. But to me, it was just like, you know, a young guy that was just being a young guy. And it was like, so what? It was like, I don't care. He plays his ass off. And I think it's kind of funny and kind of fun. And we also had a mutual respect. He was very much aware of my background with Curtis Institute, and that was impressive to him. And I also very much appreciated his love and understanding and just connection with classical music that was of a different type and level than pretty much any of the other guys in the various bands. So we had that link going as well. I'm really glad that everything has worked out the way it has. And as you observed during the whiskey show, it was like nothing bad ever happened. Almost as if nothing bad ever happened. It did, of course, but
it just felt like you all shared something. Very few people get to share.
Part of that was the fact that we got through that shit in '88 and are here now and still together and still making this amazing music and still loving and enjoying each other.
Yeah.
Gotta do a few things to make my life complete.
Sure you do.
Gotta live my life.
That's, you know, it's... It really was, you know, for me, because I'd only gotten to see you guys once, which was the second night in Hartford in 1988 when you were with Frank. So as Phil got to see you a lot.
A few more times than that.
Just a few. But to see that particular band, I mean, what an inspired lineup that Hologram band was, the Zappa band, I guess we'll call it now. What a great, great, great lineup. And Keneally is amazing.
Keneally is amazing. He is truly amazing. He's one of the most amazing musicians I've ever encountered. And he's also a wonderful person to interact with musically, personally, every way.
He's kind of a, you know, and I mean this in a nice way. He's kind of a mutant. He can play just about anything at any time. He can emulate any style. So what have you been doing with your lockdown?
Staying healthy, as I always am. Mm-hmm. I have basically not been sick a day in my adult life. I know people are kind of shocked to hear that, but I had a headache in 1974.
That was such a beautiful line.
I got to remember that one.
I'm insanely healthy and I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning every day, immediately do a bunch of high intensity interval stuff, mm-hmm. And then go out and walk at a very fast pace, about as fast as you can walk without breaking into a run for 2 miles in the cold before the sun comes up every day. I do this every mm-hmm. day. And I wear jeans or shorts and a t-shirt no matter what's going on, no matter how cold it is. And it does get cold out here in California in the winter before the sun comes up, believe me. It's too damn cold to be out there in shorts and a t-shirt, but cold exposure is very, very strengthening for your mitochondria. I'm a crazy health freak, I admit it. And I've been a walking experiment my entire life, experimenting with different forms of nutrition and all, and always researching that kind of stuff and taking care of myself. And I am still in insanely good health and insanely good shape. I still do handstand push-ups and one-legged squats and all that kind of crazy stuff. And that's one reason why I can still do this music at this level.
Well, you had Look Great Naked at Any Age, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have a copy of that. And that's a great... I have to take some of that advice because I have to lose weight now. But
well, don't take the nutrition advice on there anymore. We'll talk privately about that.
Very much so. I plan on picking your brain about that.
Sure.
Phil, do you have? We've been keeping Robert for quite a while.
Yeah. Well. Here's my final question. Can we do another podcast called "Staying Healthy" with Robert Martin?
We can actually, if you want to.
Totally, because I'm embarking on this journey. So Staying Healthy with Robert Martin, my desire is to get down to my birth weight, because which is 6 pounds 6 pounds 9 ounces. I figure if I get that way, you know, get down that low, I should be all right.
Then nothing's going to be left except your hand.
ZappaCast, the official Frank Zappa podcast, is made in cooperation with the Zappa Trust. For everything Frank Zappa, including this show, visit Zappa.com. We're also on Instagram and Twitter at Zappa. ZappaCast was created by and is hosted by Scott Parker. Our producer is Phil Circus. Special thanks to everyone at the Zappa Trust and Zappa.com. This podcast and all the musical selections contained therein are copyrighted worldwide by the Zappa Trust. All rights reserved, and until next time...
Good night, boys and girls.
Are we going to see some audience participation today?
Tonight? That's a good suggestion. I see. What could I do? I'll think about that. If I get the sense that the audience understands real good English, then we'll play some games. And if I don't, then we'll just play the show. I have to test it at the beginning of the show.